Good morning, everyone. We're going to begin our day with a presentation from Melissa on the Omnibus Vessel Baseline Amendment. Turn it right over to you.
Thank you. So I'm Melissa Hooper, a policy analyst from GARFO. I'm going to be presenting the draft Omnibus Baseline Amendment, or Omnibus Amendment to Simplify Vessel Baselines for you. So the alternatives in the document are alternative one is just status quo regulations, no changes. Alternative two is to eliminate the one-time limit on vessel upgrades. Under this alternative, vessels would still be restricted to staying within the 10% limit on upgrades of size and 20% limit on upgrades of horsepower, but could take as many upgrades to get there as they would like. This would provide more flexibility and fairness for people who, for whatever reason, were not able to maximize their one-time upgrade the first time around. It would also substantially streamline the replacement process while having a negligible impact to harvest capacity. Alternative three is to eliminate the gross and net tonnage specifications from vessel baselines. And this alternative was included because these specifications are the most variable and require costly documentation. Because this change can be made with negligible impact to harvest capacity because it leaves in place vessel length and horsepower in the specifications, which generally do more to limit fleet capacity and maintain fleet diversity. It would also leave in place, just for clarification, the volumetric limits that were recently implemented for the Atlantic mackerel fishery. And alternative four combines alternatives two and three to provide the most flexibility. So the way we approached the analysis of these alternatives was to ask a key question, which is in order to determine the impacts to the environment, the key question is whether the alternatives would increase fishing capacity or effort by increasing the size or horsepower of vessels. And so, for example, if a vessel increased its size, it may be able to fish longer trips or further offshore or hold more fish per trip, which could increase impacts to the environment. So to answer this question, we compared the baseline of the vessel to or the permits to its current specifications, as well as to what it could upgrade under the existing regulations and under the proposed changes. We did this to tell us what the fleet could look like under proposed changes compared to the status quo. So in the comparison, the baseline is the baseline specification of the limited access permit or the permit suite. The current specifications are the specifications of the vessel currently holding the limited access permit as of January 2014. The current maximum is the maximum upgrade allowed under status quo regulations. So this would be 10% of size or 20% of horsepower or the specification as it was previously upgraded. And then the future maximum, what we're calling the future maximum, is the maximum upgrade that would be allowed under the proposed changes, which would be based on the permit's baseline specifications. This would be a simple calculation of a 10% increase in size and 20% increase in horsepower from the baseline, unlimited by the upgrade history, if we're assuming that the upgrade limit would be removed. So we also looked at the number of vessels that had already used their one-time upgrade and the number that had maximized their one-time upgrade. Under the alternatives being considered, the 10-20 rule would remain in place, so a vessel that had already reached the 10-20 rule would not be able to upgrade further. So this tells us how many vessels would benefit from the changes by being able to upgrade further if the one-time limit was removed. This is an abbreviated version of Table 11 that's in the draft document. What it shows is the percent of permits in a fishery that have already been upgraded and the percent that have been upgraded to the maximum for length and horsepower. And then in the table in the document, it also includes gross tonnage. So you can see from the table that although a good chunk of permits have been upgraded for each fishery and then for the permits overall in that last line there in the table, most have not been upgraded to the maximum allowed. So potentially a lot of permits could benefit from removing the one-time limit by either being able to upgrade without worrying about being limited by the one-time upgrade limit or by being able to further upgrade to their 10-20 limit. So the flip side of this, of course, is that a lot of permits haven't upgraded yet or haven't upgraded to the maximum. They could upgrade to the maximum and potentially increase fishing capacity with potentially negative impacts to the environment. This is an abbreviated version of Table 9 in the draft document. So this table shows us the actual average increase that would be possible under the status quo versus the proposed changes. If the permits that we saw in the previous table had not yet upgraded or not upgraded to the maximum 10-20 limit, and were able to upgrade, were able to do so to the full 10-20 limit under the proposed changes, the average change in vessel length would be very small. So you can see by comparing the last two columns there, the maximum under the current regulations and the maximum under the proposed changes, the differences in vessel average vessel length are really small. So this is because the limit on all vessel upgrades is still only 10% for length. So a vessel that is 40 feet would still only be able to upgrade to 44 feet, and a 70-foot vessel would still only be able to upgrade to a 77-foot vessel. So this magnitude of change is not likely to have much an effect on fishing capacity overall, or fleet diversity, or the environment. And this table just shows the same information for horsepower. And you can see, again, in those last two columns that the changes aren't very, very large between the status quo and the proposed changes. And then the tables in the document also include comparisons for gross tonnage. This is figure 3 from page 59 of the draft document. I apologize for the small font. It might be difficult to see from far away. So what this plot shows is permits have been binned into vessel length categories and plotted to show the percentage of permits in each length category for the whole permit suite. So a permit suite is a group of limited access permits that are associated with a single vessel, because since permits can't be split when they're moved between vessels, we call them a permit suite. So the baseline here is the most restrictive baseline in the suite if the different permits in the suite have different baselines because they qualified on different vessels. So the tall bar on the left represents the permits currently on skiffs or in confirmation of permit history. For the purpose of this comparison, they were given a current value of 0 in the plot because their current size and horsepower isn't really relevant for the comparison, but their baseline, current maximum, and future maximum are still included in the comparison. So the important thing to look at here is the difference between the current maximum and the future maximum bars, which are the two bars on the right in each category. So this plot illustrates what we concluded from the tables, that there would be very little change in the future characteristics of the fleet from the changes proposed in this action, although, you know, some vessels would increase in size because it's a 10% limit. They would likely stay within the same bin that they've binned in here, or they might move up to the next bin, but also vessels would move up from the previous bin into the bin that they were in. So the overall, you know, sort of shape of the curve, the overall characteristics of the fleet doesn't change very much. It would just maybe shift a few feet larger. So this is just an example I'm showing you, but the same chart is in the document for gross tonnage and horsepower by permit suite. It's also in there for individual FMPs and for each region and state based on home port. So you can see, you know, what the impacts of a particular state or area of interest to you, or a fishery of interest. If you looked at individual FMPs, you'd see what the impact might be if, say, a permit suite that had multiple baselines, when we have multiple baselines, the smaller baseline is the most restrictive. If that permit was relinquished, the larger baseline could be used in future, so you can see that by looking at individual FMP permits, what the impacts might be. But throughout all of those figures, they show similar results, that there would be little difference between the current and future maximums. So some other potential impacts, specifically removing the gross and net tonnage from vessel baselines. Some permits have reached the maximum 10% upgrade on tonnage but have not reached it on length. So this suggests that although these specifications are correlated, some permit holders may be able to upgrade length to a maximum without being limited by tonnage if tonnage was removed from their baseline specifications. But these numbers are very small, and they're shown in the tables in the document. It could potentially increase the replacement vessel options out there if permit holders have previously been restricted in the vessels that they could select for upgrade because of tonnage or because of their one-time upgrade limit. Eliminating tonnages and the one-time upgrade could reduce or eliminate or the need for some types of vessel surveys if the specifications and the need to verify which specifications could be simplified by removing, say, tonnages. It could also reduce the time and cost to permit holders for surveying and documenting baseline and replacement vessel specifications, either by reducing the need for certain types of surveys or certain types of specifications to be verified in each survey. It could also negate the need for some permit holders to use third-party services to research permit histories and prepare replacement applications if the regulations and the vessel upgrade history were simpler to determine. And it might reduce the estimated burden of permit holder effort, which we estimate annually for each permit holder to be about 3 hours or $270 for taking the time to research the vessel history and prepare the application. We don't know exactly what the costs of third-party services are to do that, but that's an additional cost that could potentially could be saved. It could also reduce the time and costs to NIMS for researching and processing these requests. NIMS estimates processing an average of 331 replacement applications or baseline letters that involved researching the vessel's baseline or replacement history with an average cost of $45,000 annually. So from the analysis, we concluded that although the proposed changes may allow average vessel size or horsepower to increase, the changes would be small and overall effort and mortality would continue to be capped by ACL, AMs, and other management measures. So we concluded that there would be negligible impacts to habitat, protected resources, and target and non-target species. Alternative one, the status quo, would have low negative impacts to human communities because it would have offer the least flexibility compared to the other alternatives and would continue to constrain permit holders in trying to find replacement vessels and continue to, you know, maintain the existing administrative process. Alternatives 2, 3, and 4 would have low positive impacts to human communities. Because the changes are small, impacts to fleet diversity would not be expected, would be expected to be negligible, but impacts to human communities would be low positive because of the increased flexibility and reduced administrative burden. And alternative 4, which combines alternative 3, would offer the most flexibility and the most benefit to human communities compared to the other alternatives. So just a refresher on our current timeline. So I'm presenting the draft amendment to you today. I'll be presenting the draft amendment to the Mid-Atlantic Council in August. We'll have a 30-day comment period on the draft amendment between August and September, and the councils can then take final action in October, or the September-October meeting for you guys. And then we would have the proposed and final rulemaking between November 2014 and March 2015, and with the changes intended to be effective in May 2015. So what I'm hoping will happen today is that the council will vote to release the document for public comment, and then I will ask for the same action of the Mid-Atlantic Council in August so that we can take it out for a 30-day public comment period. And then I was also wanted to know the species committees, the herring, scallop, and groundfish committees provided some input, or I presented what the analysis would be in the fall, and took input from the committees on the draft measures, which generated this idea for another baseline amendment. But the committees have not seen this draft document, so I wanted to know if you would like me to present it to the species committees over the summer before the public comment period. So that's all I have.
Thank you, Melissa. Questions from the council? David Pierce?
Yeah, Melissa, thank you. After reading the document and listening to your presentation, I'm still not sure how the National Marine Fisheries Service has ranked the different alternatives regarding the purpose of the amendment. Specifically, as noted in the introduction, this action considers eliminating certain baseline restrictions to reduce the administrative and cost burdens to the industry and NIMS without adversely affecting conservation. So, again, without adversely affecting conservation. Is there any ranking of these alternatives relative to the degree to which they adversely affect conservation? And then similarly, in the purpose and need for action, it makes it clear that the purpose of this action is also to eliminate redundant regulations that the purpose of this action is to simplify and streamline the administration of vessel baselines, upgrades, and replacements for vessel owners and NIMS while maintaining the function they provide for maintaining fleet diversity and limiting capacity. Again, I'm unsure as to how the services rank these alternatives relative to achieving that specific purpose of providing for maintaining fleet diversity and limiting capacity. So, that's where I need further clarification, and I think the public will also want to know, have a better understanding as to how these alternatives relate to those specific purposes.
Sure. So the second alternative to eliminate the one-time upgrade restriction, I can clarify the document before the public comment period to clarify the ranking a bit more and specifically reference back to the purpose and need. But to answer your question here, so eliminating the one-time upgrade restriction, so I think that would provide more flexibility than eliminating the gross and net tonnages because it's very few, because gross tonnage and net tonnage and length, size overall is correlated. So there aren't many vessels who have upgraded, you know, length that didn't also increase their tonnage. It kind of increases together. So there's very few vessels that if you eliminated the tonnage, you know, that not limiting the size, the one-time size upgrade, if you kept the one-time limit in place, there aren't very many of them that would be able to then further increase their length. You know, you didn't really upgrade tonnage. There's very few that upgraded tonnage without upgrading length. So, but that alternative three does offer some benefits in terms of it's two less specifications that someone has to worry about when they're trying to find a replacement vessel. It's also two less specifications that have to be verified in a survey and that NIMS has to research the permit history for it to make sure that there wasn't an upgrade to tonnage that wasn't upgrade to other specifications as well. So it sort of just simplifies the process overall. Eliminating the one-time upgrade restriction provides more flexibility because, you know, if you do leave that in place, as I said, there's not many upgrades that you've done to size that didn't upgrade your length. So you would likely still be limited if the one-time limit stayed in place and you just remove the tonnages. But if you remove the one-time limit by itself, you know, then permit holders who had already had an upgrade but didn't get to maximize it to reach their 10-20 limit would be able to do so. You know, whether they're actually able to do that depends upon what vessels are available for replacement. You know, maybe they didn't maximize the upgrade in the first place because they just couldn't find a vessel that fell within their baseline 10-20 limit at all, in which case these alternatives wouldn't change that. So it's a little difficult to tell, not knowing what's available out there, exactly how much benefit someone would gain from this. But removing the one-time upgrade would also allow people to not worry about, you know, if you purchased a vessel or a permit from someone else, finding out what the entire history was of that permit for upgrades. Two owners ago upgraded it. You don't need to worry about that. All you need to know is what the baseline was and then what 10% of size of that is and 20% of horsepower of that is in order to determine what your potential replacement vessels could be. So, and then combining both of those offers then, you know, the benefits of both of those two alternatives in alternative four. So I think that's how they generally rank. The impacts overall for conservation, we think, are minimal for any of the alternatives because you are keeping the 10-20 limit in place, which is really the driver of limits on fishing capacity. So that's where we think the fleet diversity benefits and conservation benefits from baseline restrictions in general would still be in place. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps. You put the emphasis on where it needed to be, I guess, which is how this particular document, these proposals, will make it easier for the industry and how it will relieve the administrative burden for the National Marine Fisheries Service. That, I think, is quite clearly described within the document. But I think the public, we, the public, still need a better explanation as to, again, the other elements of the purpose that I described, and you attempted to get to that issue, you know, briefly. So, again, that, I made my point, and I hope that the document that's eventually made available to the public will really explain in a very understandable way how those purposes will be achieved, fleet diversity, conservation, all the rest.
Mike?
Yes, also thank you for the document and for a clear report. I guess one of the take-home messages is that the alternatives really are basically the same in terms of their conservation importance. And I guess the bottom line on that is because the system has evolved such that conservation is primarily dealt with through output controls, not input controls. It's also interesting to me that the council is dealing with the issue of fleet diversity through things like consolidation rules. And also our discussion about inshore-offshore yesterday and various rules that might occur there. So I'm actually increasingly wondering why we aren't even going further in terms of this issue of baselines. Why isn't one of the alternatives eliminate them altogether, which would probably have the same analysis result in terms of conservation. I don't know what the implications would be on fleet diversity, but again, I remind you that the council is addressing fleet diversity through other processes. So was consideration given to essentially eliminating these baseline rules altogether? I mean, to be blunt, my initial reaction to hearing us talk about the details of baselines for upgrades and so on is that we're sort of, it's like the analogy of being in the 18th century in medicine and trying to refine best practices for bloodletting. Now, that may be a little extreme, but this is sort of fisheries management going back quite a ways. So was it consideration given to just severely reducing or eliminating these sort of rules?
Yep, Melissa and John, you can tag team it.
So to address Mike's point, Amendment 18 is for New England groundfish, and this is for all stocks in both councils. And we said that we would take the lead on this, and we would try and get an expedited schedule. And I do appreciate the willingness of this council not to add bells and whistles to it, because clearly there, as Mike has said, we've gone to an output system, and so there is reason to think about other things that could be added to it. There's legitimate reason to do that, and we have said that is something that could be done if you want to make it your plan, and we'll hand it over to you. But and that still could be done after this one's done. But this has stayed limited in scope, and that's one of the reasons it's been able to move at a fairly rapid pace. And so, again, I appreciate the willingness of the council to keep it limited in scope so it could stay relatively speedy, and appreciate Melissa's report and at an appropriate time have a motion to keep it moving.
Tom.
Yeah, I appreciate that too, and my comments are maybe overly dramatic. I certainly support the effort because it's going in the right direction. Thank you.
Tom.
Yeah, just as a follow-up to what the regional administrator has said, this amendment that's being done by the councils and the service, I don't really like to characterize this as the services plan because this is really our joint amendment. But when it was briefed to, I think, the Groundfish Committee came back and asked the question very similar to what Mike said, which was, why aren't we trying to address more issues and remove more of the restrictions? And one of the reasons that, and the Groundfish Committee, I think, actually talked about trying to do some of that in Amendment 18. We pointed out that this effort was ongoing. So long story short, this overlaps a number of management plans. We raised the issue with the Mid-Atlantic Council at the NRCC meeting in May about whether they would be interested in pursuing more changes to the vessel baseline and upgrading restrictions. And they gave us sort of a tentative yes that they would be, that they think that the scope of these changes should be expanded. So we've written them a letter a couple weeks ago asking them and informing the ASMFC that we might be interested in exploring more changes, and we're waiting for their reply. Presumably, that would be in a follow-on action. While it would be nice, I suppose, to try and get into this one, it would mean that these particular changes wouldn't go into effect for quite some time, and these would be somewhat helpful.
I've got Terry, PK, and Dave Preble, and Vincent. Terry.
Yeah, Melissa, thanks. I know at the Groundfish Committee we had some discussions about horsepower upgrades and how 20% probably isn't enough. Because of modern engines and everything. But that's not, we're not able to do that with this current structure that the sensor, is that right?
Yes, right. So we didn't include analysis of that in this document because it wasn't an alternative, but that's something that the larger action could certainly tackle.
Derek.
Yeah. Okay. Did you look at the? Did you double check on those comments to make sure that those comments were right as far as the new Tier 4 engines and all that stuff? Have you done any of that type of research?
I didn't for this action, but you know, we had a working group. The NRCC had a working group that did some research, did a white paper that started this action, started this whole process. You know, there some, you know, we could, the PDT for the new action could do some research into that information in preparation for generating alternatives for the next action, certainly.
PK.
Thank you, Melissa. So my question is either to you or to John, then, I mean, what are you looking out of the council for this? I mean, are you looking for the council to pick any preferred alternatives under this step? And at what point do you want us to do that? Now? Today? Great. Thank you.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm really kind of aghast that we're still – I agree with what Mike said completely, by the way. I think he said it very eloquently. I like the medical reference. I thought that was actually on track. One of the things I wanted to do, in fact, the most important thing I wanted to do when I first got on the council was to see the Days at Sea system completely disappear. I wanted to kill that beast. And we used to call that the Discards at Sea system because of the number of discards that were generated by the system itself. And what bothers me about this right now is that we talk about diversity. This is the wrong tool for the job. And what it's going to do is it's going to actually act against the small boat fleet. We have an aging small boat fleet, and these people are going to want to upgrade if they stay in business. And they won't be able to upgrade enough to make it safe to bring back all of their discards. It just doesn't work for them. And so we're going to a much different system, and we're using the old tools that may have worked then in a system that was dysfunctional, but certainly aren't going to work in the future. So we're denying these boats the ability to we're making a fundamental change in the system and denying boats the ability to adapt and change to the new system. And that I find offensive. And at some point, I'd like to see, I agree with Mike, I'd like to see the upgrade restrictions completely eliminated. I see no point in having them in a system with output controls and full retention. I see no point in upgrade restrictions. As far as diversity is concerned, we're going to reduce diversity because this acts directly against the interests of the small boat fleet. I would like to see somewhere along here an alternative to just simply eliminate upgrade restrictions. I'd like to see that part of this document. I don't know where we put that in or what the structure is. I understand we want to get this out fast, and I understand I won't vote against it, whatever happens, because it is at least an improvement. But the ultimate improvement would be to just simply eliminate the restrictions. They make no sense. Another possibility, if we want to, for some reason, keep the restrictions, there should be a differential treatment of boats below a certain level. And I don't know what that length would be, but I would say that for a boat that's a small boat, in a small boat fleet, for a boat that's under 50 feet long, instead of 10%, we might say a 10-foot maximum. Something that makes more sense in terms of adapting to the realities of an entirely different model for managing these fisheries. I think this is going to work against the small boat fleet. I know it is, in fact, and I just want to see that in. And I'm tempted to put in a motion to add an alternative to eliminate completely upgrade restrictions. I don't know if that would fly. I don't know if this is the right place to put it, but I want to hear more of the discussion. But that's where I stand on it anyway.
Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, going off the comments of the people beside me here, I guess I'm going to ask the question to Tom is, what would be the process for the bigger action and what would be the timeline? Because I'm going to agree wholeheartedly with everything Dave Pierce just said, is that Preble, excuse me, sorry, Dave. I don't believe that we have a aging fleet. I believe we have an obsolete fleet. Most of these vessels are operating far beyond the capabilities that they were designed for. So if we're going to do this, we need to allow people the options, if they're going to stay in business, to have safe, efficient work platforms so they can be profitable. And not allowing horsepower or feet upgrades is going to handcuff us.
Well, with respect to process, I don't think you can effectively do this in just the management plans of the New England Council because so many boats have permits from both regions. It also complicates things for the agency to administer two different things. So I think we would have to get agreement with the Mid-Atlantic Council that we want to pursue some sort of omnibus amendment. We would presumably have to get a group together one way or another. I don't know if it would be a joint committee or something to work on the details of exactly what that would be. Some of the conversations we've had with the executive director, anyway, of the MID, and I don't know if it reflects the council members, but the chair can speak to that, is somewhat along the lines of Dave Preble, some concerns about whether the restrictions make sense for smaller vessels the way they're written, whether they should be modified. So I don't really know the extent to what they want to change it. One of the complicating factors we have to remember is that while a number of fisheries are managed by output controls, we still have a number of fisheries that are managed by input controls. The whiting fishery, for example, is still open access. The skate and monkfish fisheries and arguably at least parts of the scallop fishery are managed through input controls. So those become things that you have to consider as you do this. And that would complicate doing it. So I would expect that, you know, we would have some conversations with the MID and then we would, in our priority setting process this fall, agree to do it if we could and if they agreed to do one. And then I'm guessing that it would probably take us a minimum of about a year to get something together and get it out. I don't know that it's as complicated as some of our actions, but working with two councils can take a little longer sometimes.
I bet Rick can comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I've heard that. So we did discuss Tom's letter at our meeting and agreed that if New England is interested in pursuing a broader amendment, that, you know, it only makes sense that we join in that effort because if this is going to govern upgrade restrictions on vessels, whatever those are, we want to make sure that that's coordinated. And our plans don't have the same issues with input controls, with the exception of jointly managed monkfish. But nonetheless, we think it ought to be coordinated if we're going to do it. So we're a willing dance partner on it. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got Matt, Ellen, and David Parrish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to disagree with respectfully with Dr. Sisson and Catherine Preble here. Output controls are not necessarily a guarantee of all conservation benefits. Certainly in terms of catch, yes. But output controls don't affect impact on bottom, and that's something that we have worked very hard or in the middle of working very hard with addressing. So it's been repeated a couple times at this table that output controls equal conservation benefits. Some degrees that's true, and some degrees that's not true. And I just wanted to throw that out there before we go ahead. In general, I think we need to help this industry adapt to a new reality. There's new vessel designs out there that they could take advantage of. There's new propulsion systems. But we need to be careful about it. So I agree that we should allow the industry to take full advantage of the new technologies that are available. Vincent said it right, that people are pushing limits beyond what they should be. And anything we can do to help them is great. But at the same time, we also have a history of doing things wrong when we should be doing things right.
We've gone well past taking questions. Ellen and David, are you have questions, or are you want to go into the comment stage? Because if we're going to move into comments, I want to go to the audience for questions first. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolowitz. My question is there a presumption that increasing horsepower has a negative conservation value or a positive conservation value based on a fishery-by-fishery basis?
I don't think there's an assumption about it either way. In terms of the analysis of these alternatives, we explored whether, increasing horsepower, if it increased, if it improved the vessel's ability to tow larger gear, which might mean more catch, or might be greater impact to bottom, that could be a negative impact. But if it meant they didn't fish as long because they caught their catch much faster, then it could be the same or less impact. So the analysis, the alternative, kind of explores impacts in both directions and then concludes that because we have, because the changes are very small and that because we have ACLs and AMs and other management measures that are specifically targeted at those impacts, that the impacts from these changes, wouldn't impact the environment significantly either way.
So I'm then more specifically, increasing horsepower of a scalloper, is that a plus from a conservation standpoint or a negative from a conservation standpoint?
I guess my answer is it depends. because it's not the increase in horsepower that has the impact. It's what that means in terms of how long the vessel fishes or what type of gear they fish.
Okay, that's it for my questions. I'll come back for comments.
Thank you, Ron. Any other? Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the council. Jeff Kalin with Lunds Fisheries. My question is, did the agency consider hold capacity in the pelagic fleet as a mechanism to restrain capacity? I ask that question because I know in the mackerel plan, hold measurement is used as a rebuild restriction, and we just agreed to measure herring holds. So I would that's my question. Was hold capacity considered as a – I don't see it in the document, so I think I know the answer to the question, but I wanted to throw that out, particularly if we're going to create a broader amendment. I think it's an area we should look at because I think it's certainly got a lot more relevance than gross registered tonnage does, for example. And I wanted to make the council aware that I think we have used it as a rebuild requirement in the mackerel plan. So anyway. like to follow that?
It wasn't included in this action. It wasn't discussed.
Do you think it has relevance, potentially?
Yeah, it could be discussed for the next action, sure.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions? Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Hatch, Owl's Head. There's one thing here that concerns me, and it's a position that we some of us have been put in, is the split permits on one permit, the tonnage of two vessels in one permit. Myself, I'd like to see it just go back to the qualifying baseline. In my position is that here I've got a little 50-foot boat restricted to one piece of my permit, and then the qualifying vessel on the other side, yet I can't really utilize my permit without having really three boats and four permits. Just a tremendous financial burden trying to do this when I've got one beautiful boat that would do all of it. The other thing I would like to bring up is be careful with this whole situation. There's several people that have hired architects to build a, should we say, one-size-fits-all boat, and they just take the bow off, they take the stern off. In some cases, they take the bow and the stern off, and they fit the measurements, and through calculations, they fit the tonnage. But we've got 92-foot boats with 72-foot permits on them and 1,000 horsepower by just changing a chip. In that industry, it's a tremendous disservice to the people that try to fish by the restrictions we originally set in 94. And it's destroying the industry. When you've got an old 72-foot boat with 500 horsepower, now you've got a beautiful new 92-foot with 1,000 horsepower towing 215s versus 210s. We're just seeing it. Every year there's less product for us to fish on because these guys are just gobbling it up. And, we've got a lot of problems here, and I really like to see this topic brought up, but we need to look at the small boats, the small communities that we're losing because of our actions here, and we're failing. I hate to say it to all of you, but we're failing, and we need to do better, and we need to really sit down and figure out where we're going. But for my side of it is that we need to at least address the guys that were minimized through our actions earlier when there wasn't a fishery and we couldn't afford to buy bigger boats. We couldn't afford to replace the boat that we lost in the times when you guys are setting precedents for us to live by. And we need to at least rectify that problem in my eyes. Thank you.
Question, PK? Gary?
Yeah,
PK's got a question for you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Terry. So you for eliminating the, you would be for then eliminating everything to make it an even plane for everybody? Is that?
Well, I would be for at least bringing ourselves back to where initially we started, as far as the baselines. And I think that what we need to do, and this is something that's never been brought up, is in the interim of us coming from where we were in the 70s to where we are today, our measurements of our vessels were totally different. I mean, we had people come down, they measured your boat, and that was the side. Now, the simplified measurement, I mean, you can have, but for you that don't know, you can have, and unfortunately, a very good friend of mine proved that point, is we both had identical old Eastern rigs. I stuck to the old measurements for my boat, which fits my permit perfectly, almost within 2 ton. But he went to the fancy architect, And he comes out of it with this super-duper raised forecastle boat with 600 horsepower and a 9-to-1 reduction gear and a nozzle, towing two 15-footers. So there's a fault, and that's why I'm sitting here saying, you guys, you know, you're missing the mark on a lot of things, and we need to stop. And I know that some of you has got something to say. I'm sitting right here. Let's.
Are there any other? You have a question for Mel?
So I'm not clear. PK asked you if you were in favor of eliminating all the baselines.
We might as well, yes, because it's really a moot point as far as if you've got money enough. So, I mean, why should we bother to have that baseline restriction on the guys that can't afford to play the game? So we might as well just do away with it. It's just another restriction that we all have to live by. And I mean, that's not what I really feel. I mean, and I think you and I are on the same page. We want to restrict it to the small boat fisheries like in the Gulf of Maine. I don't think any boat over 90 foot should ever be in the Gulf of Maine, period. But that's a whole other story.
So I know we're on the same page, and I'm absolutely not in favor of restricting, unrestricted, because do you honestly think if we took all the restrictions out that we would have a small boat fleet?
I agree 100% that we wouldn't, yeah. But the other side of it is we're not going to either way, so we might as well at least let the few guys that are still trying to at least upgrade to where we can get offshore and not get beat up or half sunk in the process.
Are there any other questions for Gary from the council? Thank you. Are there any other questions? Peter? Questions? Is this a question on Melissa's presentation? Bill, you have a question? Okay, well, hold that till we get a motion on the board. We've gone, and PK, you have a question? Okay, then I'm going to, John's going to motion. Let's put it on the board, see if we get a second, and we'll go from there.
So I move that the council select alternative 4 as the preferred alternative and approve the draft for release to the public for review. And if I get a second, I'll make a brief comment.
Seconded by Ellen.
And the brief comment would be this motion, if it passed, doesn't do everything, but it's a modest step forward. It's in place in less than a year, and it's an improvement in place, in effect, in less than a year. And it's an improvement.
Comments from the audience first. Bill, you have a comment? And then Peter. Mike Button.
I'm Bill Anderson. I fish in eastern Maine down the Lubeck-Machias area. I'm actually out of Trescott. I'm a small boat fleet. I own a 50-foot boat, and I own a 33-year-old 40-foot Young Brothers. And my comment on this is, I've often looked at this, and I, you know, vessel size is a person's safety. And this gentleman brought up the size of dredge that these vessels tow. And I wouldn't be so worried about vessel size and all of that, is I would look more at limiting what people can fish with in terms of how wide their dredge can be. When you're towing for ground fish, I guess you'd be looking at how wide you're going to let that dredge spread out, no matter what it is. And if I'll use Cobb's Cook Bay for an example. Right in there, we're limited to 5.5 foot, dredge, and that limits what a boat can take. I go in there with a 50-foot boat and tow a 5-foot, 5.5-foot dredge, and I get a day's pay. And so that allow, you know, I happen to steam from my home to Cobscook Bay, and with a 50-foot boat, I can go in about any weather and go into Cobscook and get a day's pay and go back home on the same day. Whereas a lot of the other guys, you know, have moorings and stay in the bay. But my real issue is you know, if you look at managing what people are fishing with and let people own the boat they want to own, and the horsepower is another issue. If you get too much horsepower in a boat, in a scallop dragger, well, you get so big a wheel on it that you can't tow slow enough to even get the dredge to go to bottom with a 5.5-foot dredge, is what some people... Why, you see what I'm saying? So if you could look at these fisheries and manage, you know, the size of the gear people are fishing with, and like in groundfish, when the draggers first started, they were, you know, I'll go way back to a long time ago at the council here. I'm trying to think of the fella's name who told me this story. But, you know, groundfish was going down. We had a good year class coming. And he was kind of trying to encourage people, just, we got to let that year class grow up. And instead, everybody doubled the horsepower and increased the size of the dredges they were towing, and they took out the year class, and that's, you know, could be how we got to where we are with groundfish today. And what I'm trying to say is, and as you rebuild the groundfish stocks, you don't need this monstrous dredge that's as wide as a football field to catch a few fish. I mean, I'm a hook fisherman. I'd like to be able to catch fish with a hook. But anyway, that's my point, is looking at, you know, managing what people are fishing with and let people fish with safe vessels. And on the small boat side of things, like my, you know, the older vessels were narrower. They might be 50 foot long, but they're not as, you know, most vessels are fiberglass today, and these fiberglass vessels are widening out. So as a person tries to replace 150 with another 50, you're looking at, you know, if you're limited by tonnage and a whole bunch of stuff, just find, you know, you might wind up with a shorter boat. But anyway, that's the end of my comments.
Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. My name is Peter Hughes. I'm with Atlantic Cape Fisheries, and I support Alternative 4. Tonnage is a real waste as far as I am concerned, and I'm sure that everybody in my company would be concerned. Having to go out and hire a naval architect and possibly, you know, bear the cost of having to go to a shipyard to have a few select holes caught in, cut in bulkheads is really an undue cost-prohibitive problem that really has no effect on the way that we currently fish. So I support this. I'm glad it's in the discussion, and I think that if there's widespread support for this, I think that this conversation will continue with the other two, which is a lengthening in the horsepower at some point down the road. Thank you.
Bonnie.
Good morning. Bonnie Brady, Long Island Commercial Fishing Association. We support the amendment on the board there wholeheartedly. And just as a personal note, not wearing my LICFA hat, but as far as if hopefully we can get some, maybe not a guarantee, but a promise of moving forward as quickly as possible on getting rid of the limits on the length. My husband, as you guys probably know, in December, I was at this meeting, wherever we were, Massachusetts, with my daughter, and my husband's boat popped a hole in the hull. He was 50 miles offshore. It was December 18th. It was an 8-year-old boat that we got newsed because of the permit that we had for his 35-year-old Risco. As most people know, my husband, he kind of fishes hard. And so the only permit that fit his boat was the boat that we got. Let's see, hole in the hull, water on the thing. He dove into the bilge twice with 5 feet of water, trying to find where the hole was. If you guys know my husband, he's kind of MacGyver offshore, so you can imagine. He had 5 pumps going to try to get the water out, 2 of them clogged. So the engines died. Generator kept going because it was put up higher. Note to self in case you're doing that in the future. And the helo came and dropped a gas-powered pump, and they were able to dewater the plane. And then he did the infamous rip a pair of Grundons apart, take a wooden thing and bang it into the hull. And then the cutter came out, 45-foot cutter. They were puking pretty bad, apparently, and towed him back in. So by the time that I think I had emailed Tom going, got to go, he finally got in around 1 o'clock in the morning being towed. I missed the ferry that day. That was fun. So the reason why the other industry members, for those that don't understand, are asking for removing the limits isn't because, oh, our big bank accounts, let's go make the factory trawler. No. We want to just be able to be safe. Now, whether that means completely wide open or make it so that you know, 7 feet on a 72-foot boat isn't going to necessarily cut it when you're 70 miles offshore and it's blowing 30 to 40 and it's 8 to 12-foot seas and you've got to fish because whatever is closing soon. Just to make it safer would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Ron Smallwitz, I support the motion on the board, and I just want to add, in case the council gets into further discussion, that I do not think from the perspective of the larger scallop vessels, that length makes any difference either. And as far as horsepower, it has increasing horsepower has a conservation benefit in the larger scallopers because the gear is more efficient when it can be towed faster. And in the access areas, we have possession limits controlling it. What increasing horsepower will do, though, is it will reallocate scallops from vessels that are up to snuff to vessels that decide to upgrade. But from a conservation standpoint, that gets adjusted when we adjust the days at sea. So it's basically increasing horsepower in the offshore scallop fleet is a reallocation between vessels, and that's for future discussion. It's not a significant one. More importantly, though, is one of the reasons the scallop fishery is successful is we control the fishing power of the individual vessels. We do that by limiting the width of the gear and controlling the crew size. So we have a very fixed fishing unit. In the ground fishery, you don't have that. So it's totally different. And in yesterday's discussion in the inshore and offshore, the point I was trying to make is that you have to develop a fishing system. If you want to save the inshore fleet, you have to decide what is an economically viable unit and match it up to its gear. And they're technical measures, you would say, okay, we want to preserve this smaller fishing unit. You wouldn't be worrying about vessel length, you wouldn't be worrying about horsepower, and you wouldn't be worrying about tonnage. You would be saying, we call it gear restrictions. I basically say it's gear measures. You would design that fishing system around its gear. So, again, these parameters would not matter even in that case. Thank you.
Is there anybody else from the audience who would like to comment? Seeing none, we'll go back to the council. Dave Preble, Dave Pierce, Mike Siswine, Ellen, to start with.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do support this motion that's on the board. It's a move in the right direction. I think John made his point. I still don't want to lose track of the overall problem and the direction that we have to go with it. And I hope that we pursue that in the future. I think that that Ron just made a superb case for managing by gear measures. As far as length and tonnage and all of that is concerned, I've seen three boats that were identical, came off the same yard, out of the same yard, go to the ad measure, and wind up with different tonnages and even different lengths on the same identical boat types. So it's not a clean measurement. and I think that was alluded to by a number of people. So I hope that we can continue this and move it to the point where we get rid of these upgrade restrictions completely. I think that they are obsolete and are going to hamper the protection, the future protection of the small boat fleet. I think Ron's point made it perfectly. Ron made the point perfectly. But I'll support this. Thank you.
Mike?
Yeah, very quickly, I support it as well. I did want to acknowledge Matt's comment, and he is correct. There is a role for input controls, even in an output control system. I just don't think these are the right input controls because there's safety issues associated with them, and basically they're compliance issues because you can measure things lots of ways. Having said that, this is a move in the right direction. I support it.
David.
Yeah, John and his staff, they've done a very good job with this document, especially the explanation as to why the fourth alternative is the best. I do agree with that assessment, so I do support the motion, and I will I'll only highlight the fact that I do believe that we need to be very sensitive to the upgrade restrictions that currently exist and that we're going to maintain. I think they are still necessary, maybe not in the ITQ groundfish fishery, but certainly in many other fisheries. Tom Neese has already addressed this issue very well. And I'll highlight one point made in the introduction by John and his staff, and it says, in the case of hard quotas, a vessel's catch rate per trip could increase because of an upgrade, accelerating the rate the quota is taken and increasing the race to fish. These are very important elements of very important reasons why we do need to have some upgrade restrictions. We can revisit them, of course, but to just get rid of them entirely, I think that's a naive perspective that will have some very adverse consequences. So, again, I support the motion.
Ellen.
Thank you, Melissa. That was a really nice presentation, put together really well, and thank you, John, for bringing this forward. I obviously fully support the fourth alternative in the motion. I just wanted to say that I think this is a beginning. I think that we have to be very careful about changing any of the restrictions. I do believe that eliminating all baselines will be extremely detrimental to the small boat fleet. If you completely remove the baselines, you're going to end up with no day boat fleet whatsoever. It'll be very lucrative for the small boat fishermen to just sell out. And therefore, I think that we need to change them. I'm all in favor of looking at horsepower and other alternatives in a larger amendment. I think that's a great idea, but I think we have to be extremely careful about what restrictions we do remove and make sure that we are not ringing the death knell for the small boat fleet. So, Dave, I disagree that any restrictions are detrimental to the small boat fleet. I think that we can protect them, but we need to be very careful. So thank you for this, and I hope everybody votes for it. Thanks.
Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the motion. I was tempted to jump in when Dave Preble first spoke and declare these things dinosaurs and relics that belong in the Smithsonian, but I appreciate Tom Neese's comments and some others that there are still some open access fisheries and input control fisheries in part that we need to maintain something like this in the toolbox. I think this is a good start, and I also support continued dialogue with the MID on this matter and potentially a broader action that might allow for even more flexibility to industry. Thank you.
Are there any other council members who wish to comment? Okay. Matt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to hesitantly support this motion. I think we do need some. I agree with Ellen that we need something. We need to think it through. I think Ron Smolowitz is absolutely right about, you know, we need to, if we do put in some measures, they need to be the right measures. And maybe these seem not to be the ones that are going to be important, but I think we should look forward, and this is a starting point for a larger discussion. So I'll vote for it, but with hesitation.
Is there anybody else? Okay. Seeing not those who support the motion on the board, please indicate so.
Matt raised his hand slowly.
Motion carries 16-0. Is there any further discussion before we move on to scallops? Seeing none, thank you, Melissa, and good luck. Actually, why don't we make you have an initial presentation? Why don't we make the presentation and then we'll take a break? Mary Beth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to introduce the topic, we have a lot of items under scallops today to cover, and we basically have four action items to consider. We need to hopefully make a recommendation to initiate Scallop Framework 26, review and approve the Council Policy on Scallop Research Set-Aside Program, approve a research priorities for our next fishing year, and we also have a review of the limited access general category IFQ program. So Deidre's first presentation is on framework 20 sit frame.